coming up on Curious Mix. Seek.
It sort of helped to put us on the map in terms of the odd places in the Midwest.
Find.
Suddenly you feel like you're a Muppet, you know, sitting there dancing. But it's because you've gotten comfortable enough and you know where the music's going and where you're going. And
fabulous.
I have particular affinities with each of them. I just went through and found different ones that I felt like could have easily been represented that year in the encyclopedia that weren't.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer. Come listen and learn as we share a curious mix of arts and culture right after this news from NPR. I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. Listen in as we meet the people and explore the places and programs celebrating the arts and culture in our communities. Keep your ears open for these sounds and the stories behind them. The city of Indianapolis is home to many popular museums that draw visitors from near and far. The Children's Museum, Newfields, and the Eiteljorg are a few. But if you're looking for something a bit more unusual, you might want to visit the Museum of Psychphonics. I spent the afternoon with one of the organizers of this cozy little space on the second floor of the Murphy Building in Fountain Square. And that's where I learned more about this one-of-a-kind homage to the audible spirit.
Well, the first thing you see when you enter this space, my name is Kip Norman, and I am the conductor and curator of the Museum of Psychphonics. You'll notice the dim light. You'll notice the dramatic colors. But we have a little welcome sign that greets people, and we want people to read this statement because it's sort of our raison d'être, you might say. We live in a world where all things not strange are propped up as a fiction of normalcy. We aim to corrupt this charade with a new normal, a psychphonic disruption, a shared consciousness built upon outlawed narratives and talismans.
How did you collect the items that are in the museum?
The main item, I always call it our Mona Lisa, because it is the object that most people come here specifically to see this. And it is a stage prop from the band Parliament Funkadelic from their giant arena shows from the late 70s through the early 80s. They did a song series based on a song called The Mothership Connection. To dramatize that song and to make the concert a tremendous experience, they had this wonderful, incredibly theatrical event that would take place where the mothership itself would fly over the people's heads in this giant arena, just shooting out pyrotechnics, and then it would disappear into a big cloud of fog on the stage, and then it would land in front of people's eyes, and George Clinton himself, as P-Funk, would come out of the mothership and greet the people as crowds would go wild and girls were dancing on the stage. And it was pretty incredible. But in order to accomplish that, they used an old-fashioned sleight of hand, a little study in perspective. They had a tiny version of the mothership, which was the one that would fly over people's heads, so it looked like it was far in the distance. And it would head down into the stage, and then the big version would appear. So it's like small, distant, and big, close up. And so when that tour ended in the early 80s, their main roadie and guy that helped keep everything together and helped keep the band going is a man named Tom Batista. And Tom has lived here in Indianapolis for many years, and he always used to tell people that he had the mothership in a storage place somewhere. And Tom, being a very generous guy, of course, he has loaned this piece to us. And in order to give it context, we've sort of created this whole little cabinet of wonders that kind of gives a musical and historic cosmology in which the mothership can be viewed by modern audiences. This is a temple, a secret mechanical garden, an extraterrestrial portal, a museum for the post-internet age.
And George Clinton has been here and seen it.
He has. He's given us the blessing. He came to visit the Museum of Psychphonics a few years ago when he was on tour with his current band. He came to Indianapolis, and we invited him to come and have a little reunion with Tom Batista and a couple of his stage props. We have the baby mothership, and we have one of his flashlights from the song Flashlight, and we've got a couple of their road cases. And
well, all right, stop out here.
And when George Clinton walked into that space and he saw it again, and it had been more than 40 years since he had laid eyes on these things, he, you know, gasped and went up to it and laid his hands on it like he was greeting an old friend. And he just laughed and smiled and was very taken with the way things were displayed. Within this trans-dimensional sanctuary, you will discover curiosities documenting the great counter-conspiracy that is continually waging battle against the threat of big silence. We have two television sets that are old and still functioning here at the museum, and the intention behind the videos that are playing on these television sets are to set context for the idea of experimental music. The Museum of Psychphonics is, of course, devoted to the idea that music as an art form has the ability to touch the human heart, the human spirit, in a way that other art forms cannot. You have on this one television, there's some images of a woman playing the theremin, Clara Brockborn, the great theremin virtuoso. The theremin was invented in the late 1920s, and it's actually a musical instrument that plays electric vibrations. And if you remember, of course, the theme from Star Trek, that ooh, that's the theremin.
So in this video, we get to see what that was
so
like.
So in this video,
well,
yes, we get to see also a lot of unusual experimental instruments made by a man named Harry Partch, who, starting in the early 1930s, traveled the United States by hitching, on trains. He was jumping boxcars, and he started to compose music based on the things that he heard, the cadence of people's voices, the things that the hobos talked about, the idea of this kind of swirling sounds of his own imagination. And he couldn't find ways with existing instruments to replicate that, so he invented his own instruments, and some of them are really incredibly novel and produce very interesting sounds. This is a marvelous little diorama. An author named James Reeves came to Indianapolis to do research on different events in Indianapolis history. In addition to traveling around the city, he set up a special call-in line and invited people to call in and just leave messages on this answering machine so that they could describe their hopes or fears or dreams about their own city. Those writings and those telephone messages were then collected into a musical composition and a sound composition that was created by a composer named Oliver Blank. And James Reeves and Oliver Blank did a number of collaborative projects in cities around the United States. They were based in New Orleans. And so Indianapolis was an interesting experience for them. James in particular had some Midwestern roots. So he was very in tune to the idea of the manufacturing history of Indianapolis, and he was the one that created the idea of making what he called the manufactured history.
You can come and put the headphones on and hear what the people said along with the music.
Yes, absolutely. There's some really wonderful stuff in here. So,
the corner of 10th and Massachusetts Avenue. People turning around an intersection on the road. Why?
The scariest thing is cops just being around the neighborhood, scaring us instead of protecting us.
Experience these strange wonders from both the far and near corners of the world. And remember, all the world is watching. Let's give them a show.
We often feature what we call a DIY, or do-it-yourself artist who is making it. This week, Curious Mix contributor Ariana Beattie introduces us to a local woman who is using coffee to build community.
My name is Josie Hunkler. I make coffee, local commerce, and a communal place called Rabble Coffee.
Hi, can I do a large Norman Bates? Mm-hmm. And can I do a bagel with cream cheese as well?
Yep. $7.67. Do you want me to toast your bagel for you?
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you.
Rabble is my preferred medium, because I really enjoy sociology, I really enjoy people, and trying to understand what makes them feel welcomed and comfortable. So I put a lot of time and energy and just focused intention into creating a space that is going to be welcoming to the people who live around it. We're located at 2119 East 10th Street, which is on the Near East Side. Specifically, it's the St. Clair Place neighborhood. There's not a lot of grocery stores around here. I try to keep everything on our bar and everything that we need to do commerce with as affordable as possible. There's a lot of redevelopment going on in our neighborhood, which has positives and some negatives, and me and my team focus on having really intentional conversations about that with whoever has, you know, whoever brings it up, which it comes up a lot in pretty much every small business on our street. Basically, all of the appreciation for what we're doing here, our customers are our friends and really our family, and they're just so appreciative. It makes me feel like I'm doing a good job. So that's what keeps me going every day, really. It's not the pay. It's really just being able to come in and feel like I'm really a part of a community, and that the people around me are too. And we're a big part of that.
For Curious Mix, I'm Ariana Beattie.
What skill did you learn from a grandparent? How to bake a pie or change a car tire? Carmel teacher Jeff Davis's grandmother taught him how to play the ukulele. It's a skill he continues to share each week by teaching classes at the Center for the Performing Arts in Carmel. Curious Mix contributor Micah Yason takes us into the classroom.
Getting to know you, getting to know all about you.
I have been teaching ukulele since 1999, and I've been playing since I was 6 years old, 50 years. Got my first ukulele Christmas when I was 6 years old. My parents played and my grandparents played, my grandmother played.
When you're in love, my hot time flies, oh blue sky. So I'm just doing, so that's called stop time. When you just change on the chord change, you just strum down once on the chord changes.
Ukuleles, first of all, it's a really great first instrument because it teaches you chords and song structure, and you begin to pick out melodies, and it's only got four strings, and it's got limited scale length, so it's a really good instrument to start on. Mm-hmm. So that's why I enjoy teaching people ukulele.
So my name is Bill Dawson, and I've been in the program for about 3 years now, a little over 3 years.
My name is Carla Dawson, same as Bill. We've been here a little over 3 years.
For us, it's become a little bit of a passion project because we both learn differently and we both practice and understand things differently. And so it's she'll noodle on it during the day, and I'll come home from work and I'll noodle on it in a different way than she does, right? And so there's a bit of conflict, and then we start playing together, and it's a little bit fun. So
we come back and ask Jeff more questions about, okay, was this all right or was this wrong? And we walk through it. And what's nice about Jeff is that he's always changing it up and he keeps it fresh. So you can learn one song, but he'll teach it in like 10 different ways just to make it fun. And you learn new riffs and everything else with that. So it's kind of cool.
So this is an AABA song. We've talked about form before.
So I decided to try. We sat at these long white tables facing each other with Jeff sitting in the middle. I showed him my ukulele that I brought along with me.
So you play uke?
She does.
That's awesome.
Just a little bit. It's definitely like not tuned. So
well, here, we can do that quick.
Thanks.
Well, I get the big butt. That's why I get the big buck.
Thank you.
Yep. Blue sky.
I've never played ukulele with such a large group of people before. It felt different, and it made me a bit nervous. Then I remembered what Bill and Carla told me about their first experience being in the class years ago.
There are songs where where you can't help but move and dance to it. Like suddenly you feel like you're a Muppet, you know, sitting in the dance line. But it's because you've gotten comfortable enough and you know where the music's going and where you're going. And I can't have said 3 years ago that we were in the same place. We were just panicked and holding and trying to...
3 years ago, you were panicking at learning three chords and trying to strum and like actually be heard. Because what I notice now, a lot of people at the beginners, you can't get them to strum because they're just like you're afraid to. And you slowly, like you said, over the course of time, you get, you know, really good at that. And you keep moving on and get good at that. And you move to the next phase. And it's just becomes really fun. And then you get the social aspect. And they're in the same boat you are.
I'll take the leg from some old table.
I only play the ukulele at home. And many people do the same. We learn and we play on our own. So why have a class in the first place?
Well, I do a lot of teaching here in my studio. And classes... the skills are really important, but I think just as important as building community, having people to come together with that are like-minded in many different ways. In this case, there are people all seeking to play ukulele, and we build a community around that. In fact, there's a ukulele group in Carmel now that's composed of students that have come through this program. I have nothing to do with it at all. They play music that I've given them, but they play other music too. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really proud of the fact that there's a ukulele community that's growing out of my work here.
Just ahead on Curious Mix, Art Unbound.
The piece on the left, Toxicity, that's made from medical books.
And Happy Talk.
Daffodils and sailboats and burgundy and limestone and birch trees. And robins, damn it, robins.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and you're listening to Curious Mix. African American women in Indiana face disparities in health care and health outcomes, including higher rates of breast cancer deaths and diabetes. A new research project is using theater to shine a spotlight on some of the reasons why. Curious Mix contributor Jill Sheridan takes us to the Phoenix Theater in Indianapolis.
The play is called One Blood.
I was in a lot of pain.
It weaves together the interviews of 10 African American women in central Indiana.
But she gets very frustrated.
Their words describe the ways they have encountered disparity in the healthcare system. As a provider,
I had a manager tell me flat out to my face, do not go take care of this patient. She does not like blacks.
As a patient, not being given equal care.
For some reason, the doctor thinks, well, maybe our education is less than theirs, or maybe, you know, like we're not intelligent enough to have a conversation with them on their level.
The production at the Phoenix Theater in Indianapolis is the brainchild of Sally Wasmuth, assistant professor at Indiana University's Department of Occupational Therapy. Wasmuth says she was spurred by recent reports of disparity in African American women's health outcomes. She says the women she interviewed opened up.
more than one of them said that the heart is impacted by the daily stress of being discriminated against. And there are higher rates of cardiac disease and poorer health outcomes for Black women.
She says she wants the play to leave an impression.
To make sure that this message is heard by healthcare professionals so that they can look at their own implicit biases and how that might impact their care.
Sherry Harris was one of the women interviewed for the piece. She had gone to the doctor because she was having spasms. He didn't know what was wrong and didn't suggest testing. In the play, the actress depicts Harris's story.
I'm not good enough for a test. So he's like, well, I didn't think you'd want to have all that done.
In real life, Harris lives on the northeast side of Indianapolis. She's a recruiter with an engineering degree from Purdue. She was taken aback when her doctor prescribed medicine without giving her a diagnosis.
What's wrong with me? And you expect for me to take this medicine, I'm not going to take it.
Harris says after that experience, she wrote him a letter. She told him what he should have known.
Science is something that you have to rule out certain things to figure out what's what. We've not done that here in this doctor's office today.
The doctor responded and asked her back for a full examination. The play includes numerous stories of how women have been mistreated by healthcare professionals. With professionals and providers in the audience, the performance doubles as research. Assistant Professor Dr. Sally Wasmuth says the play fits the bill for what's called narrative medicine.
This practice of narrative medicine and close reading actually improves health outcomes. It improves communication between providers. It reduces medical errors.
She says healthcare providers have reported better understanding of their patients.
What we really need as healthcare professionals is more nuanced and detailed information about your particular story and how your disease or how your illness is impacting you in the context of your individual life.
Wasmuth has used theater as occupational therapy in past studies, and she says her results show it can be therapeutic. Interview participants from this play have expressed that it was. Some have also found it upsetting, including Sherry Harris. She attended the first showing.
I thought I was going to be okay, but I think my stomach started hurting a little bit during the play.
She decided not to go to the final performance, but sent a message that was shared with the audience after the show.
It's important for those who are not African American to help us. If they see something, to step in, because it appears as though we're invisible and we're disrespected.
Because as the last line of the play, One Blood, says,
we're all humans, and we all bleed the same color blood.
For Curious Mix, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Indianapolis artist Samuel Levi Jones shows his work in galleries across the country, and most recently in Indianapolis at Newfields. Now, not many African Americans have had solo shows at Newfields, much less one from Indianapolis. His show was titled Left of Center, and it came together with the vision and support of Bren Jackson, the assistant curator of audience engagement, and Dr. Kelly Morgan, the associate curator of American art. Curious Mix contributor Bob Williams met up with the three of them for a tour of Jones's show.
Bren and I really wanted to kind of go back, you know, to the beginning as best we could to show his trajectory. So we start this gallery, you know, we center really with this piece, which is one of three pieces from his master's thesis project called 48 Portraits.
What you see when you first stand in the entryway is a counterpoint to artist Gerhard Richter's 48 Portraits done in 1972. Thanks to a bequeathed 1972 Encyclopedia Britannica set, Jones saw a very significant historical slight, and he needed to do something about that.
Only like 13 African-Americans of like 736 total, you know, formal individuals, yeah. Yeah.
At first, it looks just like 48 black squares on a wall. But move forward. Get closer. Closer still. Yes, those are ghosted images, photographic portraits of famous African Americans in the arts, politics, and culture. They seem to move with you, their faces coming out of the shadows and into your vision, no longer hidden, but discernible and very striking.
But I think Sam's work here does such a great job at like mimicking for us the visual reality, right, of African American, or I'll just say Black, not even African American, but like Black humanity.
How did you do this? This is mesmerizing.
I think I spent about a year working on this, in terms of trying to figure out the aesthetic of it. But I had, and the paper is, the images are printed on paper that I recycled from those same books. So that was like my first moment of the deconstructing and like reusing the material that I use. In terms of picking the individuals, I didn't have particular affinities with each of them. I just went through and found different ones that I felt like could have easily been represented that year in the encyclopedia that weren't.
Moving into the next gallery space, Jones takes on everything from social justice to discrimination. Bryn Jackson notes the thought and consideration of what went into planning the exhibition space to start a public conversation about what the work represents.
We really wanted to take the opportunity to create space for meaningful conversation, right? So, you know, right in the middle of this, this largest gallery within the exhibition, we have this conversation space. And, you know, it's not just a reading space. I mean, as you can see, like all of the chairs are facing one another. And then in the middle of that, you essentially have what amounts to really an entire syllabus that Kelly had designed around the show. And much of that was to illustrate the ways in which Sam is really participating in a conversation that is centuries long.
A lot of these are commentary on social movements, I would say the history of oppression or like racism and gender discrimination, particularly in legal system.
This piece over here is interesting. It's a piece made from Illinois law books and titled Joshua, which was titled after a young man who was from Indianapolis who was killed in Chicago by an off-duty police officer. That's one of my favorite pieces. And then, so the piece on the right over there, untitled, that's a work that's made from art books. They were actually given to me by the museum. And that was my first one that I made from art books. So that's talking about several different things. You know, the power struggle within the art world, not from a standpoint of simply inclusion, but also like the hierarchy of medium as well. With these works, I call them paintings, but I don't use paint. So sort of disrupting that notion of like the labels that we give and the value that we give to the mediums within the work. And the piece on the left, Toxicity, that's made from medical books.
It's a tapestry.
Yeah, yeah. There's other material that I've used that I haven't mentioned. I've used football material from football equipment and actual footballs, like deconstructing footballs, and we'll see that in this next space. So these are from deconstructed footballs. These are from deconstructed tackling pads. And this is from a tackling sled that actually came from my high school that I used like 20 years ago. So this is the left of center piece that was made from Indiana law books. It has a blacks and blues sort of like representing, you know, from my experience with law enforcement, from that traffic stop that I had.
Thus the title of the exhibit, For Curious Mix. This is Bob Williams.
How does a poem inspire a visual artist? Like this. Here's Curious Mix contributor Terry Border.
This poem is by Philip Appleman, who just happened to be born in Kindleville, Indiana, I read. He was born there in 1926. He's now a professor emeritus at Indiana University. Still kicking. And his poem is called Mr. Extinction Meet Miss Survivor. They're always whispering, missing buttons, crow's feet, rust. And I try to ignore them at first, but they keep it up. Half souls, dry rot, biopsies, Studebakers. That does it. I have to yell back, virgin wool, fresh coffee, tennis balls, new pennies, robins. And that holds them a while. But they always come again, sometimes at night, sometimes in crowded elevators. Loose shingles, they whine. soil erosion, migraines, dented fenders. I hold my ears and shout, high tide, fresh bread, new shoes, oranges. And people around me straighten their shoulders and smile, and I think for a moment, I've won. But of course, you never win. And it gets to be almost a game. They give me oil spills, sewage sludge, tobacco smoke. I come back with swimming pools, butterflies, cornfields. They give me Calcutta, Gary, Coney Island. I rattle off Windermere, Isfahan, Bloomington. But by the time I'm at work, it gets serious. All lapsed memberships and auto graveyards and partial dentures and subcommittees and leaves in the eaves. And right here at my desk, I bellow daffodils and sailboats and burgundy and limestone and birch trees and robins. Damn it, robins. And my boss pats me on the shoulder, and my secretary takes it in shorthand, and everywhere efficiency doubles, I'm doing it, after all, for them. And yet, deep down, I know, in fact, it's no more daffodils than it's half-souls. What it really is morning without a hangover, but 50% chance of rain. It's a cost of living raise with a slight case of heartburn. Well, we all know about the slow leak, the scratch on our favorite record, the 7:12 40 minutes late shirt. But passenger pigeons, Studebakers, that's going too far. We have our pride, our good intentions, our metabolism. We won't be shunted off with clipper ships and whooping cranes. We're going to hang in there, all of us, because the robins may be showing where, but still, by God, they are robins.
He's the glass half full kind of guy.
Yes. And that's my daily struggle. You know, how am I going to look at the situation, you know, and today reading the news or whatever else, you know, you're beaten down and you have to try to remember the good things.
So do you have your own internal list that you refer to then?
That's a good idea, but no. I think I just drink a lot of coffee. And I try to read some good news every day. I've got a couple of podcasts that point out some good things happening, like this one, Curious Mix. And I think that's all we can do, try to keep thinking about advances and good things in life.
That's Terry Border. He'll be back again next week with another poem to help keep the zippity-doo-dah in your day. It's time to perk up our palates with a little help from Yelp, the online community of ordinary eaters who know the tastiest places in town, especially when it comes to ethnic eats. For homemade Mediterranean food, they head to Papa Fatouche in Carmel.
My name is Ilham. My business is Papa Fatouche Restaurant. It's a Greek and Mediterranean food. The chicken shawarma is one of the most popular selling item in our restaurant. We make it in a special way. We're using a special spice to make it in this way. We marinate it with orange juice, yogurt, a lot of stuff to make it tasty and tender. Does come with pita or with rice. They will feel like Middle East or Greek.
Still to come on Curious Mix, shooters.
Have somebody take a picture, somebody taking a picture of another person taking a picture, and there are three-dimensional drawings of each of those spots, so it looks like somebody's on something.
And racers.
To your winner and new champion, Kip Chagas.
I'm Jill Dittmeyer, and this is Curious Mix. An Indianapolis organization is working to end homelessness in a different way. Partners in Housing uses creative solutions to help people reach their potential, so it shouldn't come as a surprise that they follow a different track when it comes to fundraising. Curious Mix contributor Chris Siegel takes us to the Maplewood Derby.
On your mark, get set, go!
Terry Boyd.
In the back corner of Centerpoint Brewery, there's a 40-foot wooden track. The beginning of the track is at about chest height. There's a quick drop, and then it levels off along the ground.
It's made by some high school students, the robotics team at Purdue Polytech. We borrowed the track from them.
That's Katie Woods. She's the head of advancement at Partners in Housing.
Hi, everybody. This is a very loud microphone now. Welcome to the third annual Partners in Housing Maplewood Derby. Thank you all so much for coming.
There are about 20 customized wooden cars, each around 7 inches long, lined up on a couple folding tables. The scene takes me back to my Cub Scout days, when each year I'd make a small wooden car, take it over to the St. Pius cafeteria, and compete in the Pinewood Derby. The similarity isn't an accident.
We had an employee, my predecessor, a couple people ago, named Chris Maples, who died really, really tragically, really, really young. And he always wanted to do a Pinewood Derby for adults. He thought it would be this really, really cool event. So about 3 years ago, we started doing it in his honor. That's why it's called the Maplewood Derby.
Maddie Bellman and Lauren Peterson going now.
All right, Mark, get set, go!
I pull Maddie Bellman aside. Her car stands out from the rest because, well...
It's a semi-truck, so it doesn't seem like it would be super aerodynamic, but it still has some weight to it. I think I have a great design. I have my last name and then trucking on the side of it. It's all decorated, and on the front where the cattle catcher is, there's a cow sticker on it. So it looks like it got hit, but I think it's kind of humorous.
How are you feeling as they were putting your car up on the track?
Just so excited.
Maddie is good at making things with her hands. Throughout high school and college, she amassed 8 years of set construction experience, working in theater. She knows her way around power tools. But this is her first time doing something like this.
I never got to do any derby car racing or anything because I was in Girl Scouts and that was a Boy Scout thing. So being able to make my own car was really thrilling.
Maddie has a decent first heat, but the competition is pretty stiff. While we wait for the next round, I'm curious, what does the Maplewood Derby have to do with housing?
We are really looking for fun, exciting events that'll draw people into the cause. You know, you've never heard of Partners in Housing before. You don't know what we do. You come in, for this fun event, you want to build your Pinewood Derby car. You want to see it go down the track. You want the entire experience. And while you're there, you learn a little bit about what permanent supportive housing is and what the crisis looks like in Indianapolis.
Katie tells me about some issues.
When you've got really low tenant protections and you've got this issue where these rents are rising really quickly, and then we have no protections once people have been evicted, what do you do? At the end of the day, you're going to end up with a homelessness crisis.
I see people wearing the shirt with the phrase, "The solution to homelessness is housing." And that's what Partners in Housing does. They have 11 buildings around Indianapolis and one building in Kokomo. About 600 people live with them, mostly individuals and families who are at risk of homelessness without intervention. On top of that, they also offer services to get people stabilized.
We'll help you get food stamps. We'll help you get on disability. We'll help you get into rehab. We'll help you get jobs training programs. It's permanent supportive housing. So we fix the housing issue. You are homeless. You don't have a house. You are housing insecure. You don't have a house that you can afford. We fix that and then move to the other things from there.
Katie says they considered having a gala fundraiser, but that wouldn't feel true to the mission of Partners in Housing.
I want it to be somewhere where our staff is comfortable, our residents are comfortable, and the public is comfortable.
And the location, Centerpoint Brewing, was specifically chosen as the host site for the event.
So 5 of our buildings are located on the east side. Our old headquarters was also located on the east side. We really want for people to be able to see that when they come to one of our events, that this is where Partners lives. This is what it's like. Come join us.
The race is nearly over, so I go find Maddie.
How are you feeling about round 2?
I've been pretty consistent at about 2.6 seconds, I believe. So I guess consistency is better than nothing.
Participants are milling about, talking with each other about car designs. After a few minutes, the winner is announced, and it's close. First and second place is within
3/1000ths of a second.
to your winner and new champion, Kip Chiggins.
All right, so Maddie didn't get first place. Her truck was about 0.4 seconds behind the winning Derby car. But she says it's still a good time.
I always like to express myself through art and things that I create with my hands because my everyday work is pretty much on the computer. So any time that I get to throw some paint on something and drill some holes in something, it's just fun.
And Katie is confident people will walk away not only having enjoyed themselves, but that they've learned more about Partners in Housing. And maybe they'll want to get involved.
We want people to feel empowered, like they can do something. I think a lot of times with homelessness, it is this huge, impossible, hard problem. And the more you dig into it, the more the tendrils start coming out and like, oh no, you need to fix the problems with our rental laws. You need to fix the problems with the prices. And you need to fix all of these, this multitude of things. There's no easy answer. And we want to say, well, you can do that, but you can also have a little fun with it too. We can explore these things, but we can do it in a way that's lighthearted and exciting and fun.
For Curious Mix, I'm Chris Siegel.
A small Indiana town is getting a big makeover. Curious Mix contributor Lee DeNoon takes us to Rensselaer, where artists from all over the world are leaving their mark on the town.
I haven't got a chance to see them all yet, but this one is stunning. It catches the eye from a great distance. I'm delighted with that one particularly.
Rensselaer resident, art enthusiast, and retired St. Joseph College professor John Groppi takes in a three-story wall of purple coneflowers by Brooklyn, New York's Jenna Morello. She and artists from Korea, Houston, and Argentina use scissor lifts and generators to power their ascents up buildings to ease their artistry.
My name is Cobre, or Andres, that's my real name. I'm from Santa Fe in Argentina.
Cobre's stunning black and white portrait of an elderly man adorns the back wall of an event and restaurant facility known as Embers.
My painting is an homage for the working class. This is my friend. He's almost 80 years old and he's still working in the construction. He makes houses. So he's a representation for all the working class, all the working men who work really hard.
Also along the alley is a young painter from Houston, Texas. Emily Ding has chosen a wall with textured concrete blocks.
I have been working with the shape and the texture of the wall to kind of create an almost circular composition. So it's got a lot of peregrine falcons that are all leaning in and pointing the viewer towards the center.
And the July weather wasn't an issue.
It feels exactly like Houston, so I'm actually, I will say, I feel like I have an advantage here because I'm totally used to the humidity, totally used to the heat, and while it's not pleasant, it's doable for me.
Ryan Mush, the owner of Embers, is the catalyst behind this new mural project. Mush teamed up with artist Cameron Moberg 3 years ago to have a large brick facade in front of a small Embers station restaurant painted with a brilliantly colored bird. Mush says ever since, he and Moberg have been working to bring this project to fruition.
You're seeing more and more art initiatives in the street art realm in urban areas and now in more rural areas like ours.
Before working on their individual murals, all the artists spent the first day turning a retaining wall near the river into images of wildlife, a bear, fish, frog, and monarch butterfly.
Hello.
Hey there.
Across from the courthouse is a popular year-old coffee shop.
We're the little coffee shop on 231. We do like espresso-based products, and we also do like teas and fresh fruit, like smoothies, and as well as meals.
Behind the counter and daughter of the owners is high school senior Trixie Magren Jacobson. She's hearing both positives and negatives from locals.
People are thinking that it's graffiti and they should be taken to jail. People want Bomber Bob, which is our school's logo, on there. People want John Deere. People want certain stuff.
Rensselaer was dealt an economic and image-altering blow with the sudden closure of St. Joseph College in the spring of 2017.
Rensselaer has kind of been a certain way for a long time, and this art brings in more people and shows that, hey, trying to change. We're trying to be something bigger. And so it's nice that little kids are seeing this change as well as the old who have been here for a while.
In the alley behind Embers, Moosh says it's fun to witness initial reactions to the art.
I'll see someone on a bicycle or someone turn a corner and be like, wow. And just getting that response of when they see something and their natural response is positive, it's wonderful.
Moosh says he is dedicated to inspiring more art.
I want locals, I want regionals, I want national, I want international, I want anybody to come to this town and express their creativity on these walls. There's plenty of walls in this alley to go around for years to come.
For Curious Mix, I'm Lee DeNoon.
Public art doesn't have to be permanent to make an impact on a community. Curious Mix contributor Joy Hernandez introduces us to one of the creative talents at the Prairie Chicken Chalk Art Festival.
The howling freight train roars past a former go-kart track, and Kurt Lonka has his work cut out for him. Trains shake the ground, seemingly on the hour. He keeps at it, though.
You care, and you want your peers to like what you do, but not to care so much to let people enjoy your art. I mean, because you're doing it, you want people to see it.
It's taken Lonka a few years to get to this point, an acceptance of his own work in the public eye, a journey he's made with chalk.
I started out, I was really competitive and thought my work wasn't any good unless I won something, but now I've kind of gotten away from that. It's now more just about kind of, you know, interacting with the other artists, and yeah, I don't really get paid to do these, so I kind of just, you know, it's a hobby, and I like doing it.
Lonka's mini-muse is his 5-year-old daughter, Lila. She has a decidedly more spontaneous approach to art than her father.
She really taught me so much on letting go of my artwork, because even on, like, an Etch-A-Sketch, I'd be drawing something up, really thinking it looks great, and, you know, we gotta save this, and she'd come up and, phew, do it again, Daddy.
Lila would often put in requests, such as a bee or a pony or a circus. The circus theme was Lonka's first big project and was almost overwhelming.
The first year was the clown, and I did a trapeze artist and a guy getting shot out of a cannon and a big crowd behind it. And once I realized that you don't really see the stuff farther in the background, I kind of really dialed that back, because that took like 12 hours. And now, and since then, I got it down to 8 hours, and then I went to 4. So, I mean, taking out the background and stuff that don't show up in photos, so I really concentrated on stuff that would show up in a photograph through your phone or camera. And that made it a lot easier to do them quicker. And that's kind of where I've kind of went with this instead.
It's a departure from Lonka's personal art history, a corporate job steeped in fine detail.
First, I started at BOMAG, where I worked straight out of college, and I was an illustrator for parts manuals and service manuals, so I do, like, exploded views with all the nuts and bolts and how everything gets put together with the engine and everything else. And then being there long enough, I became electronic publication specialist, which was my title. And I kind of worked on the banners, brochures, any kind of advertising, like promotional items for T-shirts and everything else. And then they had layoffs here and there, and I left there and I started my own business after that.
Lonka Graphics, located in nearby Toulon, Illinois, is the main outlet for his creative energies. The signs, banners, and decals are still precise work, much like the factory manuals. Lonka has found other ways to stretch creative muscles.
Recycled art, which is like recycled banners and sign materials that I use, and I kind of create them into stuff that try to make anamorphic stuff kind of come off walls. So I'll have like a horse that's jumping off a wall, or a bee, and I'll have like tabletop things that look three-dimensional, but kind of you have to look through a camera, so you don't really get the full effect of it until you kind of put blinders on. It's basically, looking through a camera kind of lets you look through a window and kind of see it through there instead of, you know, just walking around it. You just don't really get the sense of it.
And Lonka has applied that 3D sense to his chalk art, coming up with drawings where a person stands in a certain spot and will look like they're about to be swept away by a tornado or chased by a shark.
So your vantage point is very, very important, where you stand, and then The new thing I did this year was what I call like a daisy chain, a picture in a picture. So you kind of have somebody take a picture, somebody taking a picture of another person taking a picture, and they're three-dimensional drawings of each of those spots. So it looks like somebody's on something.
The 3D design, stretched when drawn and warped until the viewer stands in the right spot, keeps that analytical side of Lonka's work. But really, it's helped him with the more emotional side of art, presenting his creations and imagination for public review.
I would say the chalk drawing has really freed me up to get back to what my degree was, which was Bachelor in Fine Arts. And it's more about the composition and flow and colors, you know, mean something, and more about getting people to feel something about the artwork. That's kind of where I've gone with it now. I've kind of gone more artistic, I guess, than what the technical drawing and stuff. And that's it. That's what I've learned with chalk drawing, is to let people see my artwork. Because really, I was that kid who didn't like people looking over my shoulder. I didn't want them to see it until it was done. I didn't want any pictures taken of it until it was completely done.
Yeah.
And it's past that. So I think that's what artists have to come out and get to that point. They just need to work through it.
For Curious Mix, I'm Joy Hernandez.
Brandon Meeks composed and performs our music. And this Curious Mix was created by
Ariana Beattie,
Bob Williams,
Chris Siegel,
Jill Sheridan,
Joy Hernandez,
Lee Danoon,
Roxana Caldwell,
Joe Bainline,
Micah Yason,
Terry Border,
and me, Jill Dittmeyer. We'll be back again next week with more Curious Mix.